You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today, Bianette Castellanos, is Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of Minnesota. We're very happy to have her with us to talk about her new book, Return to Servitude. Please join me in welcoming Bianette.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank all of you for being here this afternoon, and I'd like to thank Terry Labance for helping organize this reading. So I'm actually going to begin by talking about the origins of this project, and then I'm going to read an excerpt from one of the chapters of the book. So this story begins with a road, both physical and metaphorical. The physical road pictured here refers to the road built in 1990, connecting the rural Yucatecan Maya village that I call Cuchmil to the major thoroughfares in the Yucatan Peninsula through a newly established bus route. This road made it easier for people to leave the community, as well as for foreigners like me to arrive. Before this road in 1990, there was just a rocky path that people, in order to leave the community to visit any neighboring town or to visit the neighboring cities, people had to either travel by foot, by bicycle, or by horse. And it would basically take all day. The closest city is 2 hours away by bus. So you can see the significant impact a bus would have in this community. And this road also is, you know, when I first arrived to this village, it's also, you know, the road that there's only one road in and out of this community. So it symbolizes also the culmination of 15 years of research that I conducted in this community, beginning as an undergraduate student with an undergraduate research opportunities grant and continuing through my dissertation research and culminating here at the University of Minnesota. This road sparked my interest in this project because it signified a shift in events in the community. Prior to this road, the people who left the community were primarily men who sought wage work in neighboring cities and sometimes in the coastal towns. But after 1992, there was a significant shift in women who also left. And as of today, now there's parity. Both men and women leave. And so this had major resulted in major transformations in the community, because all of a sudden, women who were expected to stay home and take care of their parents and take care of their children, marry and settle in the community or in neighboring communities, all of a sudden found themselves with the opportunity to travel and find work just like their brothers did elsewhere. And that's what the book, Return to Servitude, focuses on. It focuses on the gender transformations that resulted from this road, and also on the broader transformations that result from tourism development in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. And these migrations are reflective also of global shifts over the last three decades, not just in Mexico, but all over the world, of indigenous communities that are traveling to urban spaces. And we see this here in Minneapolis, which has one of the largest urban Indian populations in the country. But in Mexico, this displacement began in the 1960s due to an agrarian crisis, and also was exacerbated by the neoliberal policies of the 1980s and 1990s that reduced government support for small farmers. And so we can think of this as reflected through NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that reduced subsidies for farm work, and in many cases cut them off altogether. So it's not surprising that the people had to seek wage work outside of their farming communities to be able to sustain their households. This road is also metaphorical. In the Yucatec Maya language, you greet people with the phrase bishabel, which literally means how is your path. It can also be used if you're married, like, are you married? Well, you say it's okabeli, which basically means your path has ended. So it's this metaphorical road. It refers to the paths Maya residents of Cuchmil traverse on a daily basis through their interactions with family members, neighbors, government bureaucracy, and foreigners. A Return to Servitude examines how the paths Maya communities have taken have been profoundly shaped by ideas of progress. Indeed, this physical road is one incarnation of progress as defined by the nation state, in which infrastructural development and economic investments serve as proxies for modernization. And this is one of the things that people in Mexico, people speak of. If they get a road, they're like, well, this is progress. So it's in the metaphorical and tangible. But at the same time, for Maya communities, progress is not just dependent on economic investment, it's also dependent on social well-being. And then this social well-being involves maintaining a sense of civic responsibility, cultivating a knowledge of community history, promoting Maya customs and traditions. These are the practices that are central to a road and life well-traveled. So my book examines the contradictions and tensions between these distinct viewpoints, especially in light of the transformations in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula over the last three decades, with the establishment of Cancun, an international tourist resort center dependent on cheap labor, especially that of indigenous migrants from Yucatan. So for the Maya communities in Yucatan, Cancun has become one of the central places where they seek wage work. So this road takes them to places, to this place, to hotels like these, and they reside in neighborhoods like these. These are the urban shanty towns that surround the hotel zone of Cancun, and they're located on the outskirts of the main commercial center. And as you can see, ironically, that the roads that travel to these shanty towns are not paved. They haven't. They will eventually be paved, but they are not paved yet. So they, once again, they're traveling on rocky paths that, again, markers of, you know, progress to be made, right? So in the 1970s, these migrants were welcomed, even recruited from the surrounding countryside to fill the vast labor supply needed to construct this tourist center. As Cancun expanded and gained international fame, the city attracted migrants from other regions of Mexico and also from all over the world. There's a large contingent of foreigners who work in Cancun. Today, over 500,000 people live in this city. And this isn't actually, the officials who conduct the census actually point out that sometimes this is an undercount, that there's closer to more, to about 1 million people living in the city. Because considering that people move in and out of the city constantly, it's hard to calculate how many people reside there at, you know, throughout the whole year. So you can see from this population chart that the place started off with a few families. And now by 2005, there was over 500,000 people living there. And this is a huge amount of growth within a 30-year time period. So you can imagine the kinds of transformations that resulted from these shifts. And this is what the book traces, how these transformations impacted indigenous communities that work in Cancun and also that surround it. Maya migrants make up over a third of the city's population. These migrants, many of whom arrive in Cancun in their late teens, can be found working in hotels, in private homes, and in construction. Their minimum wage salaries help support their families in the countryside, while their ancestral history and cultural practices comprise key tourist attractions. My book suggests that indigenous peoples have always been central to Mexico's efforts to become modern. Tourism projects like Cancun are nothing more than the latest manifestation in a long history of modernization projects intended to make this transformation happen. Previous projects like agrarian reform, the cultural missions, and indigenous boarding schools are just are earlier manifestations of these, and I speak directly to these different projects in the book. In the case of Mexico, state-led development projects like Cancun illustrate how this vision of modernity was enacted and reveal its limitations. Considering that indigenous people were targeted as a labor force for the construction of Cancun, I'm primarily concerned with understanding how indigenous communities negotiated their integration into Mexico's vision of modernity and how this process transformed or reinforced Maya cultural practices. So my book examines how modernity as an ideology put into practice through development projects like Cancun asks indigenous peoples to alter their sense of time, place, space, and self. I ask, how does migration and tourism alter and redefine what it means to be Maya in contemporary Mexico? And also, what do these transformations say about transnational capital? Most of the hotels in Cancun are owned by a consortium of transnational corporations, primarily U.S.-based and also Mexican-based. So these also have a say into what happens to indigenous communities in Mexico. So the book focuses primarily on two families, the Cantuns and the Maipats, because these families' experiences span the history of the community, and they also cover the Mexican Revolution and the construction of Cancun, and as such are representative of the events, encounters, and sentiments experienced by residents of Cuchmil. You can see here, this is an outline of the book. And so I follow these two families and their children, who are all migrants to Cancun. And I also follow their cousins, other relatives. The community consists of 27 households. It's a small community, but at the same time, it's unique in the sense that it has a long history of migration, not just to Cancun, but to other neighboring cities. And so I trace these migrations and how they changed as a result prior to and after the road, and also prior to and after Cancun. So I follow these families as they participated in agrarian reform, which was a project enacted by the post-revolutionary government in Mexico in the 1920s, as a way to provide land for rural and indigenous communities that were landless or that were seeking to officially stabilize their land grants. And so I trace their involvement with this program, and it basically provided land to be worked communally. And so this community has a communal land grant. And I look at sort of how that was part of Mexico's modernization projects and what indigenous communities had to say about that program. And I also follow them through their participation in the cultural missions, which were traveling missions built on the model of the Christian missionaries, and how they were sent to rural indigenous communities to teach them how to, you know, to farm in particular ways. They had taught them nutrition. They taught them hygiene. These were all the skills that the Mexican government considered to be important for a modern citizenry. And then I also trace their experiences through indigenous boarding schools, which were also established in the 1920s. And they were created to transform indigenous folks into indigenous children into rural leaders for their communities. Now, what's interesting is that the first cohort of male migrants who went to Cancun were all graduates of indigenous boarding schools. So I look at how these schools ended up, instead of turning these young men into rural leaders, they turned them into wage workers. And I'm interested in that, why that was. And part of it had to do with the fact that the families themselves sent their children to these boarding schools, not because they wanted them to become rural leaders, but because they wanted them to earn, to get a job in the city. And they needed to learn how to speak Spanish, how to read and write. And so they sent them to these schools to be able to gain those skills so that then they could send money home to help supplement farm work. So I look at these tensions between these two different visions of what boarding schools, you know, were supposed to do. And I also then follow and look at what happens when people leave their communities and what happens to Maya cultural practices and ideas of community and family and gender as these men and women go work in a transnational corporation, which are the hotels. And so I look at how they are transformed from peasants to urban workers. And I also look at what happens to their own ideas of the social relations, family relations, and their own sense of subjectivity as they go through this process. And I conclude by looking at and thinking about what is at stake for tourism as a model for development, not just for Mexico, but for many, you know, other countries in across the globe. And so what I want to read now is an excerpt from Chapter 7, which is one of the final chapters that speaks directly to this. And this is the Phantom City, Rethinking Tourism as Development After Hurricane Wilma. So I'm going to read an excerpt for it, and then after that, we'll open it up for questions. They had been warned. Trucks with loudspeakers drove through Cancun's working-class neighborhoods a few days before. People who did not live in concrete block homes were told where to seek refuge. Radio broadcasts, televised news programs, and leaflets distributed throughout Cancun's shantytowns provided detailed instructions on how to prepare for the hurricane. Residents were advised to stock up on canned foods, bottled water, batteries, and candles. Some people heeded these warnings, others did not. Residents who live in hurricane-prone regions can become desensitized to warnings of impending natural disasters. Every year during the Atlantic hurricane season, which runs from June 1st through November 30th, hurricane predictions fill the airwaves. According to the U.S. National Climatic Data Center, each year on average at least one hurricane hits the Caribbean. However, it had been over a decade since a Category 5 storm hit the region, when Hurricane Gilbert arrived in 1988. During the 2005 hurricane season, three hurricanes threatened the peninsula. In July, Hurricane Emily caused some damage in Cancun, but its greatest impact was further south. In early October, Hurricane Stan caused severe flooding and landslides in Chiapas and Central America. Based on experiences with Emily and Stan, most Cuchumil migrants did not take the predictions of Hurricane Wilma too seriously. Migrants who lived in flimsy homes did not follow the government's advice to evacuate because they feared that vacated homes would be looted. After all, these were the typical narratives circulated by the international media following catastrophes, and we can think back on Katrina and on Haiti. After the government announced that the electricity would be shut off during the hurricane, most migrants purchased provisions for a day or two instead of the 3 to 5 days advised by the government. They preferred to save their money rather than spend it on goods they might not need. And this is important because these families are very poor. They have to think critically about where they're going to allocate their resources. So given that a hurricane hadn't hit in over a decade, they figured the odds were in their favor. Once this prediction became true, residents quickly depleted the stocks of the commercial grocery stores. On October 21, 2005, Hurricane Wilma landed on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula and hovered for over 24 hours. It began as a Category 4 storm with a wind speed of 150 miles per hour. For comparison, Hurricane Katrina began as a Category 5 storm as well, but by landfall it had weakened to a Category 3 storm with a wind speed of 125 miles per hour. And so whereas Wilma landed full force and hovered for 24 hours. Wilma only caused a handful of deaths, but its ferocity and duration devastated Cancun's infrastructure. The wind snapped off traffic lights and electricity posts and stripped the trees and shrubs of most of their foliage. Flooding damaged the drainage system and the asphalt roads, creating large potholes every few feet. This debris was scattered everywhere, ruining the hotel zone's lush landscaping and making it difficult to maneuver the city by car or by foot. Over two-thirds of Cancun's hotels and several thousand homes were damaged. It took 5 days for potable drinking water to circulate and 1 week for electricity to be restored to 80% of the city's residents. Some neighborhoods went without electricity and water for over 2 weeks. Based on this destruction, national news coverage declared Cancun to be a phantom city. Natural disasters can devastate local communities and cripple economies, even in regions that are accustomed and in some cases prepared to weather hurricanes and earthquakes. We've seen this occur in Haiti and in New Orleans. In 2006, Mexico lost approximately $7 million daily as a result of hurricane damage. As one of Mexico's most popular tourist sites, generating over $2 billion in revenue, rebuilding Cancun became a national priority. The price for rebuilding was nearly $3 billion. Funded in part by international bank loans from institutions like the World Bank, insurance claims, and the Mexican government's natural disaster funds. Most hotels were open for business within a few months of the disaster. The speed with which the city recovered was praised globally and also was compared in sharp contrast to New Orleans, which took a very long time to recover. Architect Ricardo Alvarado Guerrero, Fonatur's general director in Cancun, and Fonatur is actually the national tourism board that has different institutions in different cities, and Cancun is one of its principal sites. So Guerrero explained that this tragedy provided a great opportunity for Cancun's tourist industry to, quote, remodel completely, unquote, in order to, quote, construct a new image, unquote, at home and abroad. Prior to the hurricane, Funatur's study of the tourist industry in Cancun showed, quote, noted signs of overdevelopment in its infrastructure, in its activities, in its buildings, unquote. Hotels and commercial businesses took advantage of the devastation to enact extensive renovations. What they were basically doing was they were trying to rebrand Cancun. However, these renovations involved more than a physical reconstruction. They also involved bureaucratic and workforce changes. And so they wanted to transform Cancun from a city of spring breakers to a city of expensive leisure. Through this process, Cancun shed stagnant businesses, weary facades, and surplus workers. Indeed, Cancun was rebuilt into a shiny new version of itself, transforming itself from a phantom city to a fantastic one. And they are still in the process of doing this. The recession deterred some of this construction, but I was just there in May, and they're rebuilding a whole new downtown. So instead of rebuilding the downtown, they're going to relocate it and create a brand new one. So this is why I refer to this as a fantastic process, because it's not about renovating what's already there. It's about creating a brand new version of itself. The story of Cancun's successful recovery ignores Wilma's impact on the city's largest population, its migrant workers. During the aftermath of the hurricane, workers were retained to clean up the mess, but soon after, as hotels foreclosed or switched ownership, their staff was let go. The workers who remained rebuilt Cancun. In the process, they suffered through hunger, inadequate shelter, and physical and economic insecurity. Very little money was allocated to rebuild roads, to fix damaged homes, to provide additional security, and to gather trash in the shanty towns. These tasks were left in the hands of local residents and grassroots organizations. Giovanna Cantun's experiences before and after Wilma illustrate how this grand narrative of success masked the problems involved with promoting tourism as a development model for Mexico. The day of the hurricane's landing, Giovanna purchased enough groceries to sustain her family for four days. Unfortunately, Giovanna's home was sturdy enough to withstand a hurricane. She had two bedrooms that were built out of concrete block. Her kitchen was not, and her bathroom was located outside of the home, so they had to come up with a makeshift latrine inside the home. And so this is the family plan to wait it out in the two bedrooms that were made of concrete block. And so there was nothing that Giovanna could do about her flimsy kitchen. So what they did is which was basically made out of wood planks and a corrugated cardboard roof. And so they just decided to tie everything down as much as they could and then wait it out. With tears in her eyes, Giovanna described the fear and panic generated by the force of the hurricane. She stated, "We locked ourselves inside. The hurricane lasted a long time, 3 days with wind. The wind forced the rain through the windows, which lacked panes and shutters, and the walls absorbed the downpour, becoming wet to the touch. Water seeped under the doors, flooding their home. Immediately, Giovanna and her family, quote, began to scoop the water out, but we realized that although we dumped it out, the water flowed back inside," unquote. As the storm continued, pools of water began to form in the bedrooms because these were slightly lower than the rest. I mean, most people, when they build their homes in these shanty towns, they don't take into account the fact that as the city begins to build roads, the roads are actually built higher than the homes themselves. And as a result, whenever there's a rainstorm or a hurricane, you end up with a lot of flooding and runoff from the raised up roads. So Giovanna recalled, "We placed concrete blocks on the floor so that we could walk. All we could do was lay down. There was nothing else for us to do. I have to watch over the children when they wake up because I don't want them to step down into the water." So they were basically living in a moat. Giovanna's 5-year-old daughter exclaimed to her mother, "We are going to die, Mama." Traumatized by this ordeal, Giovanna proclaimed, "We suffered a lot. A lot of water came in. We couldn't scoop it up anymore." In the absence of the state, Cancun's working-class migrants relied on each other and their extended social network for emotional, social, and economic support. Neighborhoods organized community patrols to protect homes and workers returning home from the night shift from looters and thieves. Local grocers distributed food, and everyone helped clean up the debris. In Chicoutimil, families like the Maipats gathered supplies to send to their children. So Giovanna's parents sent her, 3 days after the hurricane when the roads were cleared, they sent her maseca, which is ground corn flour, candles, flashlights, powdered milk, rice, beans, cookies, and canned foods so that they could actually feed themselves because at this time the stores were also closed. And so if you ran out of supplies, you ran out of supplies. A few migrants also sought help from tourists or foreigners they had befriended. Friends in England and Canada generously offered to wire money to help them out. I collected money from colleagues here at the university to aid in this effort. It took migrant families like that of Giovanna Cantun 6 months to get back on their feet. And this also there was also a lot of stress in the countryside because the hurricane devastated the crops. And so they, too, were affected by the hurricane. And unfortunately, it took them 6 months to get back on their feet. And just as they were about to recover, the swine flu epidemic hit, which again diminished the number of tourists going down to Cancun, and the economic crisis soon followed. So it's now only this year that tourism is beginning to pick up. So they basically, since 2005, they've suffered a lot of lean years. In spite of the devastation caused by natural disasters and of its vulnerability to economic recessions and political instability, tourism remains an attractive, if not the most attractive, alternative for developing countries. Global tourism is one of the largest industries in the world. Tourism is one of the top three generators of foreign exchange and employment for Mexico, injecting over $10 billion into the national economy. And with its $2 billion, you can see that Cancun serves a critical part of this income. Critics suggest that tourism promotes a new type of economic dependence between rich and poor countries. Given that this dependence resonates with these countries' histories of colonialism and slavery, Maya migrants' declaration of service work as la nueva esclavitud, the new slavery, makes sense. And this is where the title comes from. It's a reference to that phrase that people, that Maya migrants, refer to a period when they were indentured servants or peons in haciendas, and how in many ways tourism work is very similar to that period in time, because they don't have the freedom to be able to they're basically dependent on a time clock, and they don't have the freedom to work independently the way they did as farm workers. Tourist centers like Cancun were intended to modernize and industrialize the countryside, to transform indigenous peasants into modern urban service workers. However, the bulk of tourist jobs, which are low wage and based on seasonal short-term contracts, do not provide greater economic security than agricultural work, especially in a city based on a dollar economy. Environmental changes and fickle tastes of tourists make this type of service work unpredictable and as prone to crisis as farm work. In contrast to government expectations, service jobs have not replaced farm work. Rather, due to its seasonal nature, tourism has become dependent on the countryside, as is evident by this constant movement between Cuchumil and Cancun as people move back and forth. You know, in many cases, during as a result of the hurricane, and people who lost their jobs return back to their village and live there for a year or two until they were able to be until the economy picked up, or they were able to be financially stable enough for themselves to be able to go back to Cancun and start all over again. So this dependence has led the residents in Cuchumil to question the merits of a tourist economy. Return migrants point out that both economic systems, tourist and agrarian, provide similar experiences of economic insecurity and poverty. Carlos Maichan, who returned to Cuchumil after spending a decade in Cancun, explained, "It's the same. Here in Cuchumil, you don't spend as much as you would in Cancun. You may eat less over there, because in Cancun, one eats more meat. You may eat less over here in Cuchumil, but because in Cancun one eats more meat. However, no one earns an income, but they survive on something. Everyone sells something, habanero chiles, tomatoes. We exchange amongst ourselves in order to live. Here you don't have to buy lemons, chile. In Cancun you measure everything you earn. Everything surpasses your income. It is never enough. You can live this way year after year, and it's always the same." So given the instability of the tourist economy, and given the instability of the farm production, the migrants weigh both sides and realize that, you know, they're basically stuck in a similar predicament regardless of where they are. This critique identifies the very real limitations of tourism and of agriculture in reducing poverty among indigenous communities. Thus, even as the Mexican government praises the economic growth generated by tourism, Maya people's experiences remind us of its uneven distribution. Thank you.
I noticed the phrase becoming chingona. What mm-hmm. does that mean?
Well, the phrase chingon means to be an assertive, astute person in Spanish. It has multiple definitions, but the one that I'm using here is to be an assertive, astute person. And so it's a phrase that the Maya use to refer to themselves in Cancun, to say that in order to be able to survive in Cancun and in an urban economy, you have to be assertive and astute. And so you have to become chingon, or chingona, which is the female version. And so, but you can also become too chingon, in the sense that, you know, if you're too assertive and astute, and if you're too intent on basically improving your own circumstances, and you forget about family and social ties, then you become too chingon. And so there's this tension in Cancun as people try to make it and survive and, you know, become financially successful, that some people end up becoming too chingon, which means that they no longer participate in the kinds of community practices and rituals that they had in the past, or they sever ties with some of their family members. And that is not, you know, part of what people, the community sees as good community practice. So you have to figure out this happy balance between becoming chingon enough to survive in Cancun, but not too chingon.
Is too chingon a term they use? Or is that combining English and Spanish there?
It's they say you can be, it is chingon, but it depends on how they say it. They say, oh, they're chingon in a good way, or they're es muy chingon, muy chingon.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear you talk about how you chose the image for the cover. Mm-hmm. It's a very striking cover, and I'd just like to hear how you chose it and what you're communicating by it.
Well, I actually didn't choose it. The press asked me to send them some pictures. This is one of the pictures inside the book. And it's a picture of a young woman who's actually not in the book, But she was on her way to work. She works for one of the large Mexican-owned hotels. And she was on her way to work. And so I took this picture. I spent an afternoon with her one day, and I asked if I could take a picture of her because she's one of the few women who actually work in the hotel industry. It's becoming more common nowadays, but when I was doing my research, it was seen as something that women just didn't do if they were single and unmarried, and she was single and unmarried at the time. You could do it if you were married because you put your sexuality at risk by working in this place where people couldn't, your family members couldn't oversee you. Maids work primarily by themselves or with a partner. And so the community frowned upon that kind of work. You could work for a family as a domestic servant because then you had employer who could oversee you. But working in this large hotel and being surrounded by lots of eligible young men, because most of the hotel workers are young men, made it a risky venture. And so I submitted different photos, and this is the photo that they liked the best, and so they included that. It was hard to pick a picture for this book because I'm talking about so many things, and it was hard to find a picture that encapsulated the tensions between being, you know, working in Cancun and at the same time still identifying as an indigenous Maya with, you know, and identifying with specific cultural practices. And so I didn't really have the right image for it, but this is the one that they thought exemplified the title the best.
What's happening with the Maya language as the workers go back and forth and learn Spanish and become multilingual?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are good things and bad things happening with the Maya language. In the village, for example, they actually have a bilingual program where the kids learn how to speak in Maya and in Spanish. I mean, how to read and write in Maya and Spanish. And so they can actually, the community is, everyone is fully bilingual. The children are fully bilingual in Maya and Spanish. This didn't used to be the case. At first, everyone just spoke Maya, and they spoke a spattering of Spanish. The women tended not to speak Spanish at all because they had the least experience with outsiders. And the men, because they traveled back and forth, spoke sufficient Spanish to get by. But now with this bilingual program, the children are fully bilingual in Spanish and Maya. In the cities, though, what's happening is that the people who travel to Cancun, as a result, they pick up Spanish either because they learned it in school or they pick it up from working. But it's their children who they raise in Cancun who are at risk of not learning the language because they don't practice it as much. I mean, even though there are a lot of Maya migrants in Cancun, the primary language that people speak is Spanish and English. And so children are much more interested in learning how to speak English than they are learning how to practice and speak Maya. So what the families have done to counter this effect is they send their kids back to the village when they're little to be raised by their parents, you know, either to spend their summers there or to spend sometimes academic school years there because it's actually cheaper to educate your child in the village than it is to educate them in Cancun. And so that's a way for them to be able to retain that language because they learn it as infants, but then they lose it as they get older.
Did you find any stories of Mayas working outside of tourism or farming, like in entrepreneurship, who became financially successful outside of the kind of dichotomy that you're working under?
Definitely, and I do talk about that in the book, because there's the people who started off working in Cancun, working in the hotels, many of them are established now. They work as accountants. They own businesses. And so they've really become financially successful because they arrived at a time that where it was possible to become financially successful. Now those folk, the younger men and women who are arriving today are finding it far more difficult. But that's what's interesting about that is that because the first cohort that arrived have been so successful, they realize that in order for their brothers and sisters to do well, they need to arrive in Cancun or any city that they go to with a much better education in hand. You know, coming with a high school diploma is not going to cut it the way it used to do. You know, when they first built Cancun in the 70s, there were plenty of jobs everywhere, and hotels were also willing to invest in their employees to help them train them to be able to fill other positions because there was a dearth of workers. And they needed, you know, if you were ready to learn and work, then, you know, they gave you English language training. They taught you how to, if you started off as a receptionist, they taught you how to manage a computer so that you could become an accountant. And that's how this first cohort became so successful, because they were able to work with their employers to learn those skills. But so what they've done with their younger brothers and sisters is they've actually funded them to go on to college. So the new cohort arriving in Cancun, many of them haven't gone to college, but a good percentage, I'd say at least 10, and remember this is a small community, at least 10 of the young men and women have gone on to college. And so, but then they arrive in Cancun, and unfortunately, they don't arrive and to mop floors, but they arrive to work in security, and then they have to figure out and spend time in the hotel to be able to work up their way. So even though they have tourism degrees, they can't just jump right into a high-paying tourist job, you know, in a hotel. They actually have to work their way up the hotel as well because they have to have those connections. Or they arrive as lawyers. One young man is a human rights lawyer, and he has to work for free while he builds the connections in a law firm that he's working in to be able to then, you know, create a large client base that will then allow him to be paid. So this is so even as migrants realize that they can't, you know, that working in just tourist work and working in just farm work is not the solution, they've created alternative paths for their brothers and sisters, but these paths at the same time haven't turned out to be what they expected as well, just because of the way the system works in Mexico.
I just wondered if you could talk. I noticed on your outline in the epilogue, you had listed resistance to to the neoliberalism that has taken over the area. Could you talk a little bit about the forms of that resistance and what the outcomes have been?
Yeah, the resistance that I speak about in the epilogue is really linked to community life, because one of the ways, you know, that's, there's only so much resistance that a small community can do to such large forces. So what they do is they actually then reinvest a lot more time and energy in reinvigorating community life. One of the themes in the book is this idea that the town is going to disappear. And this is a rhetoric that's been used to talk about indigenous communities for a very long time, that as people move from rural towns to urban centers, then indigenous life will disappear. People will become, you know, ordinary Mexican citizens. And as a result, they will no longer be indigenous. And so one of the ways that people resist this discourse is to go back and reinvest their time and energy in the community. They may not do it on an everyday basis because they work in a different place, but they do it in very specific ways. And one example is there's two fiestas that are celebrated, two festivals in the town. And so migrants actually pump in a lot of money to make these grand events, so that then they can come back and enjoy them. And so instead of coming back for a day, which the festival maybe lasted one day in the past, now it can last 3 to 4 days. And so then they can come for 3 or 4 days, sometimes for 2 weeks. They'll come and spend time in their community. And they're also bringing up and performing pieces of dance or events and dances that in the past had disappeared. And so now they're reinvigorating those and performing those. They've also getting married, for example. In the past, people got married in a very traditional American ceremony with a white wedding dress, the tuxedo, even though it's really hot. And I never understood that. And so so what they've done now is that they will actually go back and get married in wearing the traditional clothes that their parents wore, which was a simple white dress, and go through that ceremony at home, in the home, rather than the church. And they'll have two wedding services. And so part of that, and then they'll invite all their family members. And so people will come because they create these great parties. And so that's another way. So through festivals and rituals, it's one way to invigorate family life. But also by just becoming involved in politics as well. Many of the migrants who go to Cancun learn, as they spend time in Cancun, they learn about labor laws, they learn about how, you know, politics works, and then they go back home and they serve as, for those who return home, they serve as local leaders, and they've opened up restaurants in the hometown in Cuchumil that sort of cater to the people who travel along that road, to foreigners and truck drivers and bus drivers. But they also then serve in positions of authority. So many of the young women who before maybe might have, you know, served in the past as auxiliary to certain positions are now taking on positions because they're seen as, you know, knowledgeable and efficient and proficient in sort of how to maneuver government bureaucracy. So that's part of the ways. So instead of ending up in Cancun and severing ties with their community, there's this constant movement back and forth. And as they try to not only revitalize practices that may have disappeared, but also reinvigorate political life. and an engagement with the nation state on terms that are much more palatable to them, right? So they actually make demands of politicians that they might not have made in the past because they have a different language that they can use now to do so.
It strikes me that that pattern is very different from what was available or possible for many immigrants that came to this country from Europe in late 19th and early 20th century. They couldn't go home again. Mm-hmm.
And it's a pattern that today there are many Maya migrants who live in the United States, primarily in Los Angeles and in Denver. And also there's some in Texas as well, and there's a large community in North Carolina. And at the same time, it's also difficult for them to go back and forth, in part because many of them are undocumented. But so this kind of migration is one way for people to be able to maintain those ties. And it's also a reason why this community doesn't migrate to the United States. They've had many opportunities and many offers by tourists who come visit these hotels who say, hey, you're a good worker. You know, I can get you a visa and you can come work in my restaurant or in my business in the United States. Will you come? And they've resisted. You know, they joke about how they're going to marry a gringa and come to the United States. But they end up marrying somebody who's either from their community or in the neighboring community, or someone from Cancun. That's happened too, and they're very much invested in this community. And they talk about that, how they have many opportunities to come to the U.S., but then they say they're far from what they call the ombligo, which is the umbilical cord of Maya culture, which is rooted in the area that they're from. And so that would make it very difficult for them to go. I mean, I know there's a lot of the young women have been offered to come to the United States with the aid of Guatemalan migrants who stay in Cancun while they prepare their travels to the United States. And they too speak about it. And I've had long conversations with them about the whole process. But in the end, nobody ever takes advantage of it because of this connection to this community. So that's what makes it very distinctive. I mean, they're from the southwest eastern part of Yucatan, which is considered to be very traditional. And so in many ways, that's part of it. I mean, there are communities there that do come to the United States, but in this case, they've chosen not to. And so I think that says a lot about the community. Any other questions?
Have anything you'd like to say about neoliberalism?
Well, I mean, the title of the book makes it sound like this is all bad. But, I mean, I try to give it a balanced look because although there are lots of negative effects, in many ways, too, the benefits have also been important to this community because they have, and I don't want to speak about, you know, they have in terms of like developmental terms, like they have progressed, but for they themselves, they speak about how they have improved their circumstances because they've been able to participate in these projects. So on the one hand, even though these projects will never allow them to gain a stronger foothold in the economy because they were never intended to do so, at the same time, they have gained they've gained more comfort in their lifestyles than they would have had in the past. And so that's the one benefit. And now what they're doing is they're trying to invest in their children's future to make sure that they have a better foothold and that they're more politically aware, they're better educated to be able to make different kinds of decisions. And so I don't want to leave it off as a complete critique of neoliberalism and tourism. There are good sides to it, but there are also the downsides. And so I try to look at how they're both beneficial and controversial. Well, thank you very much for coming. I will be signing books. And there's some copies up here.